itself. This Russian could have a shitload of intel.
So you don't think it's a trap? You're positive it was Isabel on the phone?
I thought of that, Jack said. She knew things only Isabel would know. He closed his eyes. Personal things.
Okay, then, Clark said. I've met Isabel Kashani. Pretty sure she'd die before she knowingly lured you into a trap. But notice how I said knowingly there. Just because she's clean doesn't mean the Russian is. I'll need to run my idea by Jerry and let the DNI know through channels to make sure we deconflict with anything they've got going on. But they'll agree with my assessment.
Which is?
That you should take your ass to Herat. The thing is, Isabel might even be a better source than the Russian. She seemed like a smart girl to me. If she's calling you, then she's doing it for a reason.
You won't regret this, John,
Ryan said.
Oh, Clark said, I'm pretty sure I will.
You probably will, too.
I've learned a couple of things over the course of my time in government service. No plan survives first contact with the enemy, and anything more sophisticated than a can opener is liable to break when you need it most. Simple things like this hardly ever work out like expected. Anyway, this won't be some Herat holiday, so I'm not sending you over there alone. Isabel knows Caruso, so he won't spook her. He'll be your backup. I want you traveling under your alias Diplo passport. Too many people in Afghanistan are familiar with your family. Now go pack. It's about time you had a little change of scenery. If only to take your mind off Lizanne.
Lizanne? Jack said. I don't know what you're talking about.
Knock it off, Clark said. I'm an old spy. I get paid to notice the subtle things.
Now go on. I have some calls to make.
You'll probably have to fly through Dubai out of Madrid, so see what flights you can find. If you're going, I want you out of here fast. Go tell Sherman to push Dom off his post so he can come see me.
Crap, Ryan said. This already isn't working out like I thought. Waking up at Dara scares me more than going to Afghanistan.
Jack wasn't privy to the calls among Clark, Jerry Hendley, and Mary Pat Foley. All he knew was that Clark gave him the thumbs up to travel. Foley liked to keep as much separation from her office and the campus as possible. But sometimes they had to talk in order to prevent the team from running headlong into an operation that they knew nothing about. Deconfliction was, after all, one of the main purposes of the ODNI. Caruso and Ryan made the one-hour Iberia flight from Seville to Madrid, then had a few hours to stock up on snacks before they boarded an Emirates flight to Dubai. They traveled under black diplomatic passports, obviating the need for visas in most countries. Caruso used his own name, but for obvious reasons, Ryan went by an alias. It was standard procedure to pick a legend with the same first name, adding a layer of safety if someone recognized you and called out. Given Ryan's family connections, he decided to go a different route, choosing the name Joseph Joe Peterson. Jack was just too obvious. Their connection in Dubai would give the two operatives enough time to navigate the airport and eat something that wasn't warmed up on an airplane microwave. Emirates was a pretty cushy airline, but the Hendley G5 had spoiled them. Commercial travel also put a crimp in their normal loadout of gear. Both men traveled with only a small backpack that they carried on. No weapons, no gear other than their clothing, some emergency food bars, and a satellite phone. Both wore good boots and light jackets. The desert could get chilly at night, and the jackets doubled as extra pillows in their cheap seats. Ryan had never been on an Emirates aircraft that didn't have a new car smell to it. The planes were plush, well-appointed, and dripping with customer service. Unfortunately, the cavernous A380 was almost full. Jack and Dom had to settle for two economy seats in the rear, jammed against a bulkhead so they didn't recline all the way.
Sorry about this, Jack said as Dom slid across and situated himself next to the window.
No worries. The lines around his eyes said he was none too thrilled.
You know me, cousin. I'm always game to help you save the girl.
Jack chuckled at that, picturing the fire in Isabel's eyes.
Yeah, well, this girl's kind of a badass.
Caruso yawned.
Even a badass needs to be rescued once in a while.
He rolled his jacket and shoved it between his head and the window, eyelids already drooping. Adara and I have an agreement. Sometimes I save her. Sometimes she saves me. Chapter 39 Ding Chavez had the eyeball. He was having a hard time figuring out if Dehosha and his creepy killer girlfriend were inexperienced or if they just believed they were invincible. Dehosha kept checking his watch, which was weird, but not overly so. Whatever the deal was, neither of them seemed to be looking for a tail. They'd come out of the hotel a little over a half hour before, dressed for a casual evening. Fournier wore a loose light jacket over a dark t-shirt, perfect for hiding whatever kind of pistol she'd have under there. Dehosha, wearing slacks and a long-sleeve paisley dress shirt, carried a leather messenger bag slung diagonally across his body. Nice man purse, Chavez thought. The wily bastard had gone all day without logging onto his computer. Nobody did that. The team had decided that if he didn't pop up online by that evening, something had gone wrong with Gavin's malware. As it was, they were operating in the blind, with no idea of what Dehosha was up to. A stubby two-car commuter train squealed and rumbled down the tracks in the middle of Calle San Fernando, north of the Hotel Alfonso XIII and the Hard Rock Cafe, where Dehosha and Fournier had apparently gone for drinks. They were inside only a half hour before they came out and hung a left, hand in hand, looking for all the world like tourists. It seemed odd to Chavez that someone would come to a city as steeped in history and culture as Seville and go to a Hard Rock Cafe. But, he supposed, if you were from Europe, a Hard Rock offered a change of pace, and at the very least, a cool t-shirt. It was late evening, and the streets around Seville University and the Real Alcazar Park teemed with people heading off for pre-dinner drinks. Flocks of tourists took advantage of the temperate spring weather before it gave way to the incredible heat of an Andalusian summer. The Plaza de Toros was less than a kilometer to the northwest. There had been another bullfight tonight, which added substantially to the crowds. Hundreds of people, some milling in place, some rushing here and there, broke up the human terrain and made it relatively easy for Chavez to follow without being spotted. It didn't seem to matter. Dehosha and Fournier were so engrossed in sightseeing that they never even looked behind them. Heads up, Chavez said over the radio. They must have somebody out there running counter-surveillance. Maybe, Clark said. Or maybe they're just dumbasses, Midas offered. He was waiting around the corner, ready to pick up the eyeball if the couple turned past the university onto Del Cid. Or, Clark said, they're professional criminals, not intel experts. They might think about somebody following them once in a great while, but they're more likely to worry about personal security in the mano a mano sense of things. What is going to try to hurt me in the here and now, rather than who might be building a file on me? Not very smart, Adara said, but it works to our advantage. We'll see, Clark said. They may not be experienced in tradecraft, but I don't get the impression either one of them is stupid. Dehosha checked his watch for the fifth time since leaving the hotel. Chavez reported this to the rest of the team. This dude has to be meeting someone. He doesn't seem to be in a hurry, but he is concerned about some kind of appointment. Maybe he's killing time, Adara offered. Right turn on Del Cid, Chavez piped. They're crossing to the west side like they might be going to walk around the Plaza de España, or that little park right beside it. Lots of trails there, if I remember my map correctly. I have the eye, Midas said, crossing San Fernando on the opposite side of Del Cid. Chavez continued walking straight, passing him at the intersection without making eye contact. Copy that, Adara said, sounding a little breathless. She was dressed in running shorts and a t-shirt that was loose enough to conceal her copper wire neck loop and microphone. Her radio was in a small fanny pack. I'm a block to your east. I'll jog down to the park and get a little ahead. They're picking up their pace, Midas said, not running exactly, but walking with purpose. Are you burned? Clark asked. I don't think so, Midas said. They're still chatting, but they're definitely walking faster. Chavez turned right at the next block, working his way through the food stalls and carnival rides of the San Sebastian Park night market. The smell of grilled meat and fried bread made his stomach growl, but he hustled along toward the east side of the park, not following yet, but providing backup for his now diminished team in case things went bad. He wasn't so much upset about Ryan and Caruso heading off to Afghanistan as he was realistic. Even the full complement of 6 wasn't optimum for a prolonged surveillance op. 4 was little better than a wing and a prayer. Still, this was the field. You soldiered on, doing more with less, and grinned about it because in the end, stopping evil dumbasses in their endeavors to do bad shit was still the best job in the world. They've cut into the park, Maida said, just south of the Plaza de España. I'm jogging loops, Adara said. I'll head that way and pick up the eyeball. Stand by, Maida said. I'm with a crowd of tourists that happen to be taking the same route they are. No need to switch up yet. Crisscrossing paths through the orange groves, palms, and jacaranda made it possible for the team to move in a little tighter. Their targets meandered back and forth, stopping now and then to read signs or watch the docks. As Maida said, killing time. Dehosha checked his watch again. They were on the western edge of the park now, and he pointed north, up the 6-lane avenue called Paseo de las Delicias. Looks like he might be heading toward the hotel, Maida said. I'll keep to the trees, Adara said, running parallel. Copy, Maida said. Still northbound on... They're crossing the road, Maida said, east to west. Chavez broke out of the park a half block behind Midas, planning to pick up the pace so he could take over the eye. But he could tell that was not going to happen. It was as if someone had just flipped an on switch. Both Dehosha and Fournier became much more animated. Chavez watched as they waited for a lull in the traffic and then trotted across. There was no more hand-holding or gazing at the sights of Seville. They were going somewhere. Are they turning? Clark asked, as if he already knew the answer. Chavez figured it out at about the same moment Clark did. Well, shit, he said, as their targets continued to jog to the banks of the Guadalquivir River Canal and hop deftly into a waiting inflatable boat. Moments later, the outboard growled to life and the little boat sped south into the darkness. Chavez reported what he'd seen. That, Maida said, was pretty damn slick. I should have thought about the river, Clark said. Midas, how much luggage did you see in the hotel room last night? Not much, now that you mention it. You want me to go check his hotel room while he's not in it? No, Clark said. If the malware is working, I don't want to spook him in case he has someone watching it. We better pray he logs on with that computer, because he could be going anywhere. It's only 50 miles to the ocean. If he wanted to, he could be in North Africa by morning. Chapter 40 Elizaveta Bobkova took a sip of mineral water and closed her eyes. Her joints were stiff, her mind lethargic. She probably just needed to get away from the noxious fog of Pugin's cologne and go for a long, relaxing run. Gorev lay asleep on a couch, snoring softly. It was Pugin's turn on post with the laser mic that was aimed across the street at the bedroom window of Senator Chadwick's Arlington, Virginia condo. What little talking did occur came from Chadwick, and from the sound of things, her young assistant, Mr. Fite, was having trouble keeping up. Pugin's lips spread into a lascivious grin. These Americans are strange animals. All animals are strange, Bobkova said after another sip of mineral water, if they are watched long enough. Pugin tapped a pencil on the notebook beside his computer. They are going to be hungry after this round. The desk in front of Pugin contained a wide assortment of gear, all of it dedicated to sniffing, listening, watching. The laser microphone and receiver, both aimed at the window across the street, sat on tripods to the man's left. A ladder-like Yagi directional antenna was on his right, mounted on its own stubby tripod and pointed at the same condo, collecting cell phone, wireless router, computer information, and 2 IP addresses Bobkova believed to be Chadwick's smart television and dishwasher. The antenna gleaned information from the other condos, along with the IP address of any passing vehicle that had GPS or other connectivity. A phenomenon that was becoming more and more of a reality these days. Bobkova wondered if the average American suddenly became aware of the digital cloud that followed them around, how many would melt into a pile of emotional goo? If you had a mobile phone in your pocket, grocers could be fully aware of which products you loitered in front of with your shopping cart. Online advertisers knew if you'd looked at a certain type of bra, and bombarded you with ads for that bra if you had the temerity to decide to buy something different. Automobile dealerships knew if you put off that oil change for a few thousand miles beyond their recommendation, giving them a reason to deny your warranty claim. It was probably healthier to be oblivious to the constant intrusion, at least in the short term. Bobkova had taken to disconnecting her own life shortly after joining SVR, placing a small square of electrician's tape over the camera of her laptop while she was still in training. Just as liars found it difficult to trust, watchers were always the most paranoid. Bobkova was especially proud and disgusted at how simple it had been to find out the senator's mobile phone number. The life of a politician and Chadwick's own narcissistic personality made her especially active on social media. There were more close-up photographs of her face on her accounts, perfectly framed in that helmet of hair, than Bobkova had ever seen. It was as if she'd ducked into one of those shopping mall photo booths and the camera had gone on overdrive, spitting out strip after strip of photos of the same mugging face. Chadwick took care to attach that face to worthy causes, making her, at least in the judgment of her handlers, a more electable senator. Homeless shelters, crisis centers, museum openings, all provided backdrops for her toothy smile. To her credit, she kept her personal life personal, except for her dog. It was a handsome little thing, as far as dogs went, a mix of border collie and something with a curly tail. Bobkova had once adopted a stray in Afghanistan, where the locals did unthinkable things to the dogs. She'd invested a great deal of emotion, only to have the stupid thing die on her once she got it back to Russia. Chadwick cared enough for her little mutt to share the camera with it on a few occasions, and enough to have it licensed and tagged in case it became lost. It was a straightforward matter for Bobkova to zoom in on one of the hundreds of social media photos and find the mobile phone number engraved on the metal dog tag. Once she had the number, it was simple enough for Bobkova to set herself up as a man in the middle. Less than an hour later, she was able to go up on the phone and begin logging incoming and outgoing calls, collecting packets of information on all Chadwick's internet sessions. She recorded login data, passwords that the senator would surely use more than once, building the pattern of life that was needed to cause someone's death. Elizaveta Bobkova did it all through gritted teeth. The pasty sycophant Dudko would soil himself were he to spend 1 minute in the field alongside her. And still, he pushed her relentlessly to make things happen quickly. Bobkova reminded him that she knew what she was doing. She was thorough, she was meticulous, and she was good at her job. He did not care. It had to happen tonight, and it could not splash back on anyone from Russia. Pugin raised his arms high above his head as if he'd just scored a goal. And they are done. Bobkova shook her head in disgust, as much for her thoughts of Dudko as this operative with the hairy ears. Pugin rolled his chair away from the table and pointed his pencil at the session data that was now scrolling down his computer screen. I told you she would be hungry. Bobkova walked over and bent down to get a better look. Pugin's cologne was actually quite nice once it had a chance to wear off a bit. Or perhaps she was just nose-blind to it. See? A table for two at the Morton Steakhouse. Pugin made a note of the login and password she used for the reservation website. They would use it to try and gain access to Chadwick's other applications. Bobkova watched in real time as Michelle Chadwick, or possibly her carp-lipped boy toy using her phone, made 7 o'clock dinner reservations in Crystal City. Bobkova knew the place well. Morton's Steakhouse faced the street, but had another entrance inside the underground mall. Her meeting with Reza Kazem had taken place across from the Starbucks in the very shadow of the restaurant. She often ran along the Mount Vernon Trail, which followed the Potomac across the street. Bobkova folded her arms, pacing the length of the hotel room several times as she thought through the particulars of this location. There would be enough people to offer the right amount of panic and melee, making the killing highly visible, as Dudko had instructed. There were several other restaurants in the vicinity, seafood, tapas, noodles, even a place that specialized in bison. Some diners would drive, but many would come and go via the metro, funneling them right past Morton's to reach the terminal. The crowds would at once provide the necessary witnesses and cover their escape. Bobkova had studied the security cameras in the Crystal City Underground in advance of her previous meeting with Reza Kazem. Then, she'd wanted to be seen, but such preparation was a habit. She'd send Gorov to check the area again and disable the camera directly in front of the restaurant on Crystal Drive. Ideally, Bobkova would have liked a little more time to build her file, but Dudko insisted she rush things. Bobkova was smart enough to see what he was up to. Certain news stories were already being written, little flames that thousands of internet bots would fan into a larger fire across the web, liking, tweeting, sharing, commenting. Monday morning drive time radio loved a good conspiracy. More tweets would follow, many of these from real people, helped along by the bot army. One story would bolster another until even the most cynical began to doubt their convictions. Mundus vult decipi. The world wanted to be deceived. Senator Chadwick would die tonight, and the American people, or at least a substantial portion of them, would blame the man who she accused of having his own assassination squad, the man who stood to gain the most peace from her death, President Jack Ryan. Chapter 41. Reza Kazem sat behind the wheel of the stolen Fath Safir, Iran's answer to the Jeep CJ 4x4, and shielded his eyes from the sun as the gigantic plane crabbed into a stiff wind over the makeshift airstrip. A woman in her 50s sat in the passenger seat, hunched over a small notebook in which she made frequent notes with a pencil she kept behind her ear. She wore red lipstick and dark eyeliner, but the pencil appeared to be her only jewelry. A lock of steel-gray hair escaped the scarf and blew across her face, but she left it there, engrossed in whatever she was doing. She hardly ever spoke, except to herself, with whom she carried on many lively conversations that she noted in her little book. Overhead, the IL-76's engines screamed as it came in on final approach. Carved out of the desert in the valley east of Mashhad, the runway provided an adequate, if not ideal, landing spot for the Ilyushin. The strip was 1,500 meters, 1,000 meters short of what the airplane would need to take off again, had it been loaded to maximum weight. Reza Kazem didn't care about that. In a short time, it would be some 74,000 kilograms lighter. The woman in the Safir's passenger seat looked up suddenly at the sound of the engines, startled from her stupor. "Tell your people to take great caution putting the missiles inside the launch tubes." Kazem drummed long fingers against the steering wheel. 2 hours and 36 minutes until the next American satellite passes overhead. It is better the great Satan does not see what we are up to, don't you think? This is true, the woman said, her voice dripping with condescension. But the great accuracy we require will be lost if the components are damaged even in the slightest way. Secrecy will not matter if we cannot hit what we are aiming at. She went back to her book for a moment, then suddenly looked up. Do you shoot? Kazem nodded. I have, on occasion, fired the weapon. Are you very good? A professor of engineering, she spoke bluntly, unaware of any possible consequences for the words that escaped her lips. I suppose, Kazem said. I want you to think of this, she said. Imagine one of your friends fires an average mortar over your head. This round travels at, say, 1,600 meters, or approximately 1 mile per second. You are tasked with shooting this projectile out of the air with your Kalashnikov, which shoots a projectile that travels at approximately 700 meters per second. The mortar is a larger target, but traveling over twice as fast.
You'd want the best bullet possible, would you not?
That is exactly what I would want, Kazem said.
Then please, the woman said, be careful with the missiles. The analogy I posed is not far off from what you propose we do.
Chapter 42.
Special Agent in Charge Gary Montgomery sent two agents from Presidential Protection in separate cars to park down the street from Senator Michelle Chadwick's apartment as soon as he'd gotten off the phone with President Ryan. Once the trigger was pulled to get things moving, he called his bosses. It took less than 10 minutes to be conferenced in with Director Howe and his right-hand Deputy Director Kenna Mendez and a service lawyer.
There always had to be a lawyer.
There was the usual worry about protecting the good name of the Secret Service. The way the lawyer saw it, this operation could go three ways. Nothing happened, in which case all was rosy. Secret Service personnel saved Senator Chadwick from an assassination, and all was rosy. Or something got bungled, Chadwick died, and the service looked inept. Or even worse, responsible. Director Howe and Dee Dee Mendez had almost 50 years of experience between them. Both had cut their teeth as post-standers, criminal investigators, protective agents, supervisors, and eventually SAICs of large field offices. They knew the vagaries that an agent in the field had to deal with. The fact that this was a covert detail. Chadwick had not asked for protection, and should not even know she was being protected, added an extra level of difficulty. Without knowledge of her schedule, they would lose the ability to conduct advance surveys of locations before arrival. Everything would be a seat-of-the-pants move. Doing this right, and the Secret Service prided itself in providing flawless protection, was next to impossible. The lawyer pointed out that while there was nothing illegal about Secret Service agents following the senator unannounced, as long as they did not spy on her, they were under no statutory obligation to do so. The operation would probably violate policy on several points, and possibly some federal rules in regard to overtime pay, but he would have to research it. Montgomery groaned at that. Given enough time to look, government lawyers could find a way to make anything against the rules. In the end, Montgomery reminded the director that there was a fourth scenario. The service could refuse the request, Chadwick would be murdered, and the trust and confidence of POTUS would be lost. Director Howe said that the phone call was only a way to get everyone on the same page, and there'd never been any question that they would do what the president asked, so long as it was not illegal, immoral, or unethical. Hiding in the shadows to safeguard a hateful woman from potential assassination was uncomfortable, but it was none of those things. The call ended with the lawyer urging Howe to reconsider. A perfectly safe option, since his words would be forgotten if all went well, or he would be vindicated if things went sour. Montgomery found his own position more precarious. No one said it out loud, but if this operation went bad, he'd be the one to take the blame. Even President Ryan couldn't protect him if he was fighting for his own job. Where virtually everyone else in law enforcement was trained to seek cover during a gun battle, men and women of the United States Secret Service trained to make themselves the larger target, to stand up and fight while others in the team hustled their protectee away from danger. Shitty position or not, Gary Montgomery knew nothing else. The president had asked him personally to stand up and fight, and that was all there was to it. Several members of the administration, including the chief of staff, were afforded Secret Service protection. These details were relatively small, just a handful of agents, and stealing even one could jeopardize coverage. Montgomery raided his own team first, as well as drawing from V. POTUS, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Washington Field Office, and USSS headquarters. In the end, he had a small group of 5 female and 7 male agents. Most of them looked young enough to be Montgomery's children, but came with glowing recommendations from their superiors. 3 would work night shift, a basically static post that did little but watch the condominium, while the other 9 agents would work days, shadowing the senator wherever she went. He'd chosen agents who lived near or inside the Beltway. Some of them lived within a few miles of one another,
though their schedules made it so they hardly ever crossed paths. The Secret Service was a small agency, and most knew one another, or at the very least had friends in common. There was a certain amount of smoking and joking as the detail came together, and people caught up on one another's lives. Montgomery held the first briefing at the nondescript orange brick building on H Street that was Secret Service headquarters. He'd been honest with everyone, including the lawyer, who sat at the end of the long conference table. "There has been no articulated threat," he said. "Yeah," Mike Ayers said. "Not to be indelicate, but have you listened to the senator? I'm sure she's got a million people who hate her ever-loving guts. Sorry, boss. Just saying what everyone is already thinking. It's the ones who don't make a loud fuss who we have to worry about." The whip-smart supervisory agent from WFO was a natural choice as Montgomery's second-in-command. "I hear you, Mike," Montgomery said, "but let's not say it outside these walls." "Copy that, boss," Ayers said. "One more thing," Montgomery said before everyone deployed to their various assignments. "Normally, we protect from harm or embarrassment." "I don't give a shit about embarrassment, but the senator must not be harmed. If you see something brewing, shut it down immediately. If you can do it without her making you, so much the better. But I don't want you to get caught up in that." The evening turned out comfortably warm, considering what Elizaveta Bobkova had in mind. A low sun behind the hotels and office buildings of Arlington threw Crystal Drive and much of the Fountain Park across the street into shadow. Bobkova settled back in the park with a half-dozen other people sitting on benches. Most of them probably lived in one of the many nearby apartments adjacent to Reagan National Airport. Some looked like they'd just finished running on the Mount Vernon Trail. Others were just out to soak up a pleasant evening. If they stayed around long enough, it would prove to be an evening they would never forget. If Chadwick stayed an hour and a half, she'd be out at about sunset, which Bobkova thought would be just about perfect. Morton's was directly across the Potomac from D.C. proper via the 14th Street Bridge, so she wouldn't have been surprised to see any number of Washington glitterati. The eateries around Crystal City were favorite places to lobby, be lobbied, solicit funds, or request favors for funds that had already been solicited. It was a dirty business, politics. Dirtier even than espionage, Bobkova thought, so one might as well conduct it over a nice meal. She'd not been surprised when Chadwick showed up with someone other than her callow aide. Fight was there, but as a driver, not a date. He dropped the senator and her dining partner off in front of the restaurant, and then sped away in her black BMW X5. Heading south, presumably to wait until he was called to pick them up again. A happy convenience. The routine would almost surely be repeated in reverse, with Fight pulling up to the curb in front of the restaurant, and Chadwick slowing for just a moment as she got in the waiting vehicle, allowing Gorev the chance to strike. Tonight the senator was meeting with a strapping lumberjack of a lobbyist for a large pharmaceutical company. Bobkova could not remember his name, but she recognized his bearded face from more than one of the many Washington cocktail parties that everyone loved to whine about, but no one wanted to miss. Both Chadwick and the lobbyist had checked their watches between the BMW and the restaurant, making it a good bet that each had another commitment after dinner. "Any minute now," Bobkova spoke softly into the tiny microphone clipped inside the lapel of her blouse. Chatting quietly to oneself on a park bench did not seem quite as bizarre as it had been before the advent of mobile phones. Both men acknowledged. Pugin from a bench inside the underground mall across from the small post office. His post gave him a vantage point to make certain Chadwick and the lobbyist didn't decide to take the interior exit and go for a walk in the underground without anyone knowing it. The double glass doors gave him a clear view of the street as well, and he was close enough to render assistance if Gorev needed it. Gorev had the trigger job. His youthful face didn't look it, but deep down, he was much more ruthless than Pugin, and Bobkova needed ruthless. Gorev would loiter on Crystal Drive, outside the security camera's field of view, as if waiting for a ride. Bobkova, who could see the front door, would let him know when Chadwick made her exit. At this point, he would walk up and shoot her in the face. Pugin would exit the mall then, acting the good witness and yelling at some imagined assailant up on a rooftop. It took the human mind a few seconds to process surprises, especially violent ones. Most bystanders would follow Pugin's gesture to the vacant rooftop, struggling to make sense of the situation. Some of them would have clearly even seen Gorev pull the trigger. Some would stand with pocketed hands while they stared in shock at the broken skull and brain matter that were nothing at all like they appear on television. Overwhelmed senses would be unable to process the input of gore and blood and gunpowder. Oh, some good Samaritan may try and tackle Gorev, but he was strong and quick. Pugin would move in as well, as if to grab the attacker, all the while clumsily blocking anyone else. This was a good plan. With any luck, it would all be over soon. Bobkova sat up a little straighter on her park bench, willing her leg not to bounce with nervous energy. Arlington was crawling with police and federal agents. Dozens of them were sure to emerge from the woodwork like termites at the sound of a shot. She wanted to be gone before anyone knew she'd been here. Carousel is still stationary, Special Agent Soong said from inside Morton's. Several less flattering codenames for Chadwick had been suggested, but Montgomery reminded the team that these things had a way of coming to light, and stuck with Carousel. Alpha is stationary, said the Secret Service agent on top of the Crystal Place apartments. She lay belly down behind her Remington 700 rifle, peering through the reticle of a Night Force scope, cheek against the adjustable comb of the Accuracy International chassis. Stay on her, Christy, Montgomery heard Ayers say. Special Agents Miller and Woodruff responded next. Bravo still stationary. Charlie still stationary. Alone in his maroon Dodge Durango 200 meters away, Montgomery nodded to himself. He'd liked to have thought the team would have snapped to these threats simply because of their appearance, but he knew the real reason was a friendship that went back to his first days in the service. The baby agent who'd sat next to him at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center during Basic Criminal Investigator School, CI they called it, had been convinced even in the early 90s that technical measures were the future of law enforcement. Josh Parker had carried around folders crammed full of data on what was then extremely new technology regarding cell phones, digital cameras, and the emerging internet. He was always eager to share his ideas with anyone willing to listen. Montgomery, who even then looked like a ham-fisted Mickey Spillane character with a clothing allowance and better haircut, had a tendency to depend more on shoe leather than on binary code. But he'd sensed this agent trainee was onto something. He and Parker became good friends throughout the weeks of CI and then the more specialized Secret Service training course in Beltsville. Special Agent Parker had eventually gone on to head the Secret Service's Protective Intelligence Division, working behind the frosted windows on the uppermost floor of Secret Service HQ. Parker's drone had provided the first lead. Strictly speaking, the 15-mile circle around Reagan Airport was a no-drone zone. There'd already been an incident where a small commercial UAV had crashed onto the White House lawn. Few things beyond actual gunfire got the Secret Service quite as animated as remotely piloted aircraft flying up to the window of the president's house. The service conducted numerous tests, working on methods to stop intrusive aircraft, and, coincidentally, how they might employ such aircraft themselves in furtherance of their mission. Josh Parker headed the research. He'd launched his newest drone from a park two blocks away from Chadwick's apartment, simply to get some up-to-date aerial video of the neighborhood, possible surveillance vehicles, anything out of the ordinary. He'd suggested launching the drone every hour to look for patterns, and changes in those patterns. The drone went up for the third time at 5 minutes after 6 o'clock, just in time to watch a brunette woman exit the back side of the apartment building across the street from Senator Chadwick's residence and get into a forest green Ford Taurus. That would not have been abnormal at all, but for the fact that the woman got in the car and did not drive away. 2 minutes later, a white male in his 20s came out of the same building but walked to a different sedan. He and the woman pulled away at the same time, heading the same direction. Parker had taken his drone up another 100 feet and watched the two vehicles drive out of the neighborhood. They jumped on I-66, heading east. The departure would simply have been logged by the command post. But a third male, this one shorter, darker, and older, one of the agents called him Shifty, came out the back door of the same apartment building and drove away using the same route. Chadwick left her residence just before 6:30 with her assistant Corey Fite behind the wheel of her Beamer. 7 U.S. Secret Service vehicles trailed, loose enough not to be seen, close enough not to lose one of the most ubiquitous types of vehicle inside the Beltway. She'd stopped and picked someone up at the Clarendon Metro Station Kiss and Ride lot, and then continued on Clarendon Boulevard, generally paralleling the route taken by the 3 people who'd left shortly before her. Parker uploaded pertinent sections of the video with the clearest images of each person and sent it to everyone on the detail. The angles weren't ideal, but they were good enough that the Shifty guy was identified sitting on a bench inside the Crystal City Underground Mall almost as soon as the team arrived on scene. Montgomery and the others hadn't known where Chadwick was going before she arrived at the steakhouse, so it took them a few minutes to get set up. One agent followed the senator and her male companion inside. This agent, a female who'd be able to check on the women's restroom without being questioned, quietly displayed credentials identifying her as Secret Service Special Agent Madeline Soong, and told the maitre d' that she needed to conduct an advance for a visiting dignitary. Protective details were common in and around Washington, so the maitre d' gave her a run of the place. The lighting inside the restaurant was dim, and Special Agent Soong, dressed in a smart navy blue suit with an open-collar button-down, blended in with management. Chadwick was self-absorbed enough that she paid no attention to the intense Asian woman checking for would-be threats not 20 feet away. Shifty's presence on the bench just outside Morton's was enough for Montgomery to put shooters on top of the nearest apartment buildings, to the north and south across Crystal Drive. He wanted coverage of the drop-off and pickup point with 2 long guns as well as 2 sets of eyes. Parker's drone would have come in handy here, but the proximity to Reagan Airport made that problematic. Agents on the ground identified the younger man and the woman from Chadwick's neighborhood before the snipers made it to the rooftops. They were given designators that corresponded to the order in which they'd come out of the apartment. All senses humming now, Montgomery couldn't help but wonder if there was some unidentified Delta out there to go with his Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie. Soong's voice came over the radio. Carousel is imminent departure. They're paying the bill now. Okay, boys and girls, Special Agent Ayers said. On your toes. Chapter 43. Montgomery clutched the steering wheel with both hands, leaning forward, fighting the urge to get involved. Chadwick's BMW X5 pulled up just before she walked out. Movement Bravo, an agent said. Another piped in. Charlie's up, walking toward the street. Then, Gun Bravo! Gun Bravo! In front of the restaurant, Delray Witherspoon, a 6'3" raw-boned special agent who'd played tight end for Mizzou before joining the service, bounced Bravo's head off a concrete pillar before he could bring up the pistol. Bravo collapsed on the sidewalk. Special Agent Soong moved to her right, body-checking subject Charlie at the moment he tried to come through the glass doors, knocking him back into the arms of the 2 agents who'd sprinted up behind him. Chadwick and her date got into the Beamer and drove away, seemingly none the wiser that she'd narrowly avoided execution. Subject Alpha running east, one of the rooftop shooters said, calm, sniper-like. His voice held the unique buzz of someone whose face was pressed against a rifle chassis. She's on the paved trail, heading down toward the airport. Montgomery hit the steering wheel. Ayers would follow Chadwick's vehicle, staying with her to look out for secondary attacks. With the remaining agents either on the roof or across the street, Alpha was as good as gone. Oh, hell no, Montgomery muttered, slamming the Durango into gear. Flooring the accelerator, he turned quickly off Crystal Drive into the parking lot to his right, cutting between the 2 apartment buildings. He'd gotten enough of a look at Alpha to see she had long legs and an easy stride. Probably bought her running shoes by the gross. There was no way he'd be able to outrun her. But he was a boxer, and boxers knew how to work the angles. The Mount Vernon Trail stretched for 18 miles along the Potomac River between George Washington's estate and Roosevelt Island to the north. The entry onto the trail from Crystal City ran east through the woods as it crossed the tracks and then cut almost due south to follow the George Washington Parkway before finally joining with the trail via a concrete ramp overlooking Reagan National Airport. In other words, if she wanted to run north and stay on the trail, Alpha would have to run south first. Montgomery had run it before with friends from the U.S. Marshals Service, headquartered in Crystal City, and he knew every sickening foot of it. He took the Durango as far as he could, eventually finding himself stopped by a swimming pool behind the apartments. Out and running immediately, he scrambled over the rusted metal wall along the train tracks. He tore the knee on his khakis when he hit the gravel, but his predatory drive put him past caring. He hit the woods at an all-out run, crashing through dense greenery of oak shrubs and sassafras, half sliding, half bounding down the side hill. The thump of evening traffic on the GW Parkway covered the noise of his approach. Montgomery slowed a hair as the vegetation began to thin and he neared the edge of the woods. Alpha was to his left, still running as if pursued by demons, just about to go under the bridge. Montgomery dug in, sprinting up the grassy hill to GW Parkway, where he waved at oncoming cars like a madman. Traffic was never good inside the Beltway, but Sunday evening gave him a relative break, and he was able to scramble across in fits and starts like the frog in the video game without getting squished. Energized at having reached the high ground in advance of his target, he stepped into the woods where the Crystal City access teed into the main trail and waited for Alpha to run directly to him. He drew his Sig Sauer, but there was no need. Alpha stopped dead in her tracks and raised her hands when she saw the badge hanging from the chain around his neck.
"My name is Elizaveta Bobkova. I am the Russian attaché for economic affairs, and I have diplomatic immunity."
Gun up, Montgomery kept his distance. Without being ordered, Bobkova knelt on the grass, put both hands on top of her head, and crossed her ankles. She knew the drill. An Arlington PD patrol unit pulled to the shoulder of the road and stopped, pistol out, surveying the scene from behind the safety of his engine block. Montgomery tapped the badge around his neck.
"Secret Service, I could use some help here."
Two more APD cars showed up in as many minutes, more relaxed with the situation now that they had superior numbers. Montgomery holstered his sidearm and let the officers, who were accustomed to working as contact and cover, take Elizaveta Bobkova into physical custody. "Nice Glock," Montgomery said when one of the Arlington officers passed him the G-43 they took from her waistband. "Small, but a little much for an economic attaché." Bobkova cocked her head to one side. Sweat beaded on her upper lip. Her chest heaved from exertion and nerves. It was getting dark now, and the blue and red lights of the squad cars flashed off her passive face.
"You are a very large man," she said, her Russian accent stronger than it had been earlier.
Her eyes were almost shut, as if she were trying to figure out some riddle.
"I do not mean to say fat. You are large in good way. But I cannot believe a man as large as you caught up to me on foot. It is remarkable."
Chapter 44
Urbano de Hoxha lay on his back in a plastic lounge chair, reading a car magazine and daydreaming about the new Bugatti he could now afford to buy. An intense midday sun reflected off the white deck and dazzled the blue water of the pool. A heavy gold chain lay across his hairless chest, glinting along with the buckle of his swimsuit. Skin-tight silk covered with gold brocade, the suit was modeled after Talahia, the breeches worn by matadors. It was complete with tassels, called machos, and de Hoxha thought it looked ridiculous. But Lucilla had bought the suit for him in Seville. As with the actual talahia of a matador, the suit required de Hoxha to arrange his partes nobles to one side or the other. In the case of the matador, this was away from the side he used to confront the bull. A wise choice, considering what the sharp horns of a Spanish fighting bull would do to those noble parts. The suit might look foppish, but it certainly sparked some interesting games in the bedroom. He'd hardly gotten a moment's sleep since the deal with the Russians went through. Killing always brought out the best in Lucilla Fournier. Groaning now, he set the magazine aside and sniffed the air, taking in the odor of cut grass on the rising heat from the fields below the 18th-century villa. His fields and his villa. He gazed down the hill at the olive grove below. His olive grove. And it was only the beginning. Oh, this place was well and good by Portuguese standards. But now he could buy an island of his own if he wished. His estates would dot the globe. If the Russians could be trusted to keep their word, and why shouldn't they? Then there would be many more deals to come. Not too shabby for a former Oshoa errand boy. He caught a flash of movement in the corner of his eye and let his head fall sideways to watch Lucilla's tan body arc off the diving board and enter the water with hardly a burble. She was that way with everything. Precise. Perfect. It seemed she hardly even had to practice. She merely conceived an image of what she wanted to do, replayed it over and over in her mind until she could picture the most minute detail, and then did it. Killing Ugo Gaspar had been Dehosha's idea. How to do it had been hers. She suggested it be public, demonstrating to others in the business that there was a new player in town who was not to be underestimated. Anyone who could murder the feared Frenchman in broad daylight, in front of his armed bodyguards, no less, was surely someone to be reckoned with. The same with Don Felipe. She'd taken special care procuring the toxin and devised a method of delivery that could be carried out under the nose of the Russians without causing them to get overly nervous. Shielding his eyes against the blinding sun, Dehosha whistled at Lucilla. It was not a cat call or a summons. Lucilla was not the sort of woman who answered to a snapped finger. It was a whistle of awe. Both hands on the deck, she pressed herself up and out of the pool, swinging her leg up in a fluid motion that would have been awkward for most people. She accomplished it with perfect strength and grace. Like a goddess just appearing on earth, her wet skin glowed under the golden evening light. She tipped her head to get all her hair on one side, and then used both hands to wring out the excess water. She wore the same black two-piece she'd had on when she'd shot Gaspar, with the same alluring tear in the cloth over her buttock.
"It is so hot today," she said. "You should come in the water."
"I will," he said. Her face fell into a frowning pout. She stumped her foot before turning at the edge of the pool, arching her back, looking over her shoulder to taunt him with the ripped swimsuit.
"Do not wait too long. The water is making me wrinkle."
"Just a tiny bit of work to do first, my little prune. You know, banking matters." He reached for the laptop on the teak table beside his lounge chair and opened it up. Lucilla had kept him so busy that he'd not logged on since returning home. It took only a moment to connect to Wi-Fi. Chapter 45. 16 hours and 3 layovers after leaving Seville, the aging Ariana 737 carrying Jack Ryan Jr. and Dom Caruso made a rapid descent toward the Herat airport, south of the city. There were few missile attacks of late, but the pilots didn't seem to want to try their luck by staying in the air too long at low altitude. The other passengers rocked sleepily in their seats, reading or chatting happily with seatmates, apparently used to the rapid descents. Strong winds buffeted the airplane even after they'd landed, causing it to shake as the pilot took them down the runway toward the sad-looking terminal. Ryan rolled his neck from side to side, doing little to get rid of the kinks brought on by long hours of sitting, and more than that, the anticipation of seeing Isabel Kashani. He beat his head against the tattered headrest. "I swear I saw a cloud of dust fly up from the upholstery when we touched down." Caruso rubbed his face and leaned forward to look out the window. "This whole place is a dust cloud. I can already feel the grit between my teeth. You think they have any other colors here besides brown?" The lone Ariana flight attendant stood well back in the galley as the passengers deplaned. Her smile was friendly enough,
But she said nothing to the passengers, mainly Afghan men, as they filed past her. Apart from the constant shove of a wind that seemed made more of dust than air, the first thing Ryan noticed was the smell. The odor of cooked meat and burning plastic reminded him of a time when he was 9 or 10 and had hidden his G.I. Joe on the barbecue grill. His dad had lit the burners without checking under the lid. Jack wondered about snipers as he walked across the tarmac, but forgot about danger altogether the moment he got inside the unnaturally quiet terminal and saw Isabel. She wore a loose cotton dress in charcoal gray and a blue headscarf. He'd expected her to be in a t-shirt and tight jeans, like the last time he saw her. But her clothing was relatively progressive for a severely conservative place like Western Afghanistan, where many women wore a burqa. Two men stood beside her, glaring hard at the newcomers. One was darker than the other, with a head that was very close to being shaved and a long pointy beard that reminded Ryan of a billy goat. His head was up, hands at his sides, shoulders hunched forward in a slight crouch, as if spoiling for a fight. The other was taller, better fed, but with an intense sadness around his dark eyes. Like the first man, he had an olive complexion, but this one had a full head of hair, combed straight back, dark, but with a rusty tint in the right light. Ryan suspected he was the Russian. Neither man smiled. For that matter, neither did Isabel. She simply nodded in greeting. "Thank you for coming," she said. "The van is this way." Caruso and Ryan were shown to a battered minivan across the street in the small lot, a warm, dust-filled wind whipping them the entire way. The guy with the buzz cut introduced himself as Hamid as he slid open the back door. He left them to get in the van themselves and walked around to get behind the wheel, apparently uninterested in learning their names. Isabel sat up front in the passenger seat. The release button that would have allowed someone to reach the rearmost seat was broken, forcing the remaining three men to squeeze in together on the ratty bench seat in the middle of the van. Dovzhenko took the far window, directly behind Hamid, and Jack took the middle, riding the hump. He didn't mind. It gave him a more unobstructed view of Isabel. He leaned forward, hands on his knees, sweating and more than a little nervous at seeing her again after so long. "I'm surprised you didn't give me one of those Indiana Jones slap-to-the-yap welcomes when you saw me." Isabel gave him a sullen side-eye without turning her head. "Oh, I would have," she said, completely serious. "But public displays of affection are frowned upon in Afghanistan." Hamid took the Kandahar-Herat highway north past the Afghan National Army base, turning west before entering Herat proper. They drove past fields of saffron crocus and poppies, and orchards of almond and date and pistachio. Stands of willow and cottonwood trees flourished in the valley, in stark contrast to the barren hills. Jack tried to make small talk, but Isabel gave only curt answers, so the conversation never went anywhere. He couldn't help but notice that she hardly even looked at him, and never met his eye. "You've been here a year?" She nodded, but explained no further. "How's Avram?" "My father passed away," Isabel said. "Jack, I want you to listen to me very carefully. We do not have to catch up. You do not have to pretend to be interested in my life." "Isabel?" She cut him off. "I never would have called and taken you away from your busy schedule had it not been absolutely necessary." Caruso bounced a fist on Jack's knee, showing his fraternal support. "Look," Ryan said, "I get that you're pissed at me. But are you sure you want to do this here, in front of everyone?" "Do what?" Isabel said, still staring forward. "I am only apologizing for taking you away from your busy life." Jack fell back in his seat, wedging himself between the two other men. "Suit yourself. It's good to see you too." He turned to the Russian. "What's your story? Did you get in some kind of trouble and—" Isabel wheeled in her seat, finally looking Ryan in the eye. "What was I to you, Jack? Were there other Iranian women after me? Do you have some sort of Persian women fetish?" "I thought we parted on good terms," Jack whispered. "Your father made it very clear that your safety was paramount,
and that any association with me put you in danger. My father? She spat, fuming now. You would blame this on my father when he is dead and cannot defend himself?
Jack looked to Caruso for help, but got nothing. A silence fell.